Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this December 22nd, Tuesday, the 22nd of December, and it's getting a little bit lighter today. Okay. Well, I have one announcement before we talk about the top news stories of 2009. We did book recommendations yesterday, and they were flying. We had so many recommendations, and we are going to have a link. Rhonda's going to post it in just a few minutes as soon as she goes over to the store and get my bag with all my work in it that I left at a store yesterday. This time of year, you know, you got the cards, you got the stuff that you lost, and I lost a few things. And so at any rate, I wanted to tell you that the book recommendations, and we've been getting more on Facebook as well. They're always great presents. And Daniel Golden, who was with us yesterday, has a blog. So that link is on our Facebook page right now, so you can go there and get more book recommendations and keep it going. It's great to have book recommendations going all the time, I think. So we're just at that Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you'll be able to get the link because many of you have called and said, what was the name of that book? We just couldn't keep track of them because there were so many. So I wanted to say that. We're going to talk about the top 10 news stories of 2009. I love to do these kinds of shows because you think about some of these listings that made the top 10 for the Associated Press and you say, did that happen in 2009? It seems like it was years ago because everything is happening so quickly. David Crary is joining us, a national reporter for the Associated Press. Each year they do a poll of U.S. editors and news directors for the Associated Press's annual poll. We won't tell you what all of the stories were, but you can imagine what number one was, which is the economy, and the Obama inauguration was number two. That seems like it was a couple years ago now, doesn't it? They also did, this is not as scientific, really, but they also enabled members of the general public to select their list of top stories, and that was a separate vote on Facebook. So 117 ballots cast for the top 10 stories, and the economy received 61 first-place votes out of those ballots. We're happy to talk with David and welcome your phone calls as well. As you think about the top 10 stories, you may want to give us your top two or even your first story of the year. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, David. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks
Hi.
For having me on. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very good.
Good. How many years has AP done this?
We started this in the 1930s, I
Ooh.
Believe. So it's quite an old venerable tradition, about as old as our famous football polls. So they're a different group of voters, but both pretty venerable traditions.
It would be fun to post all of it. Maybe you do this, all of the top 10 for the past how many years now, since the 1930s. It'd be fun to look at it.
Yeah, there's some striking things. I started it right at 9/11, and grimly, that was probably the most lopsided poll. We almost felt embarrassed to do the top story poll that year because it was so obvious there was only one overwhelming story. Yet, you know, we put out the ballots and got the votes in, but that was not a fun task to report the obvious selection of the terror attacks. Usually it's a little more open and a little more interesting to see what the results are.
Yeah. So you're polling how many people? Who's involved in this?
Well, you know, it's very open. We don't have a pre-selected panel. We send out ballots to all of our member news organizations, which is more than 1,000. So in some years we've had 200 or 300 votes. This year it was a little less for reasons we're not sure of. So it was, I think, 117 this year. But one person from each of our 1,000-plus news organizations is eligible to vote.
Mm-hmm. Number one, I guess it's obvious. It does seem, though, as though the Obama inauguration was several years ago to me now, doesn't it? It's hard to believe it was less than a year ago.
Well, that's right. And we tried to phrase the wording on our ballot to sort of have not only the inauguration, but his taking the reins of power, as it were. I think we put in, Obama inaugurated and, you know, faces many challenges, to sort of encourage people to think of it as not only that day, but sort of the start of his presidency. That's always a challenge for us, is how we phrase the the ballot entries, because some of the stories just aren't one-day stories. They're an ongoing thing. Like, for example, Afghanistan. You can't pick out one day and say, oh, this happened on day X. It needs to be the sort of year-long story. So it's a challenge just to get people to think that way. And we try to be careful in how we write the ballot entries.
First story, the economy. I would imagine it's going to continue to be in the coming year. We had, as you write, a $787 billion federal stimulus package. I think we're still wondering where a lot of that money went. And the economy, except for those some on Wall Street who have paid back the stimulus money and are getting their huge bonuses this Christmas time, which most of us are not, particularly people in the news business, right?
That's right.
It's a big, and the number of people who are unemployed right now, it's a little frightening.
It's staggering. I think the economy probably, for some good reasons and a lot of bad reasons, for each individual American, probably a lot of other people around the world, it's sort of an inkblot story. I mean, for each person, it means something different, some different challenge, different hardship, different worry. And that's probably why it was the number one pick, because everybody is concerned about it in some way or other, perhaps different from their neighbor or different from someone on the other side of the country, but nobody's sort of insulated or immune from it.
Well, and what about this disparity that we're seeing? I guess it reflects on another time in American history, or maybe several other times in American history, this disparity between investment banks' profits and profits of the American public, or the salaries that we're looking at between these two groups of people. It's quite striking.
It's glaring. It's hard for me to say if back in the 30s, say, people felt the same kind of disconnect. Certainly, I don't remember in the past couple of decades such as kind of in-your-face phenomena. Maybe it always was there, the disparity, but it's so glaring, and everybody's aware of it now. So I think there's a little more resentment. I think financial elite is more self-conscious now. Whether that turns out to be a good thing or not remains to be seen. But I think those highly paid bonus-getting financiers have more of a sense themselves now of the disconnect.
Right. Well, you know, those people are so valuable. If you gave them smaller bonuses, they would just go elsewhere, right?
So they say.
That's what they say. What about that $787 billion federal stimulus? I don't think there's been a whole lot of reporting done on where that money went, and if indeed it has been a stimulus to some sectors in the American economy or not.
Yeah, it's such a great question and very hard to answer. People at AP and other big news organizations have been trying to do that, and I think one of the problems is that there's no single answer. You kind of touched on it. Some has been spent, some hasn't. Some of it's done some real tangible good in terms of creating jobs, and other segments of it's probably not. So it's such a mixed picture that it's tough to sum up in bite-sized news stories, and it's probably frustrating to a lot of people that you can't come up with a good barometer for it.
Right. The president had a job summit. Was that substantive, do you think, or fluff?
Certainly not substantive yet. It's, I guess, important to get people thinking about creative new ways to create jobs. So there's nothing wrong with, what's the phrase, jawboning. But I don't think he really expected it to have results within weeks or even a couple of months. It's such a tough issue to solve.
What about unemployment?
I don't see it going down very fast, which is sad for all of us, I think. I guess there's a chance it's going to inch down a teeny bit, but boy, getting from 10% to 9%, I don't know if that's going to be any kind of cause for celebration.
Right. I think about all those people, particularly at this time of year, and how many people must be having such a hard time of it, David.
Oh, and it keeps happening. I mean, my sector, the layoffs haven't stopped in journalism and in a lot of other sectors, too. It seems like there's so few islands of sort of stability where people can say, we're fine, my company's fine. I think those are the exceptions rather than the rule, and that's pretty tough psychologically.
Right. And they keep coming in waves, right? You get one wave, another one during the same year, then another one.
Yep. It's really brutal, and I think the kind of short-term jobs that are created. What I read the other day that thousands of people are going to get temporary jobs with the Census Bureau to do the census, and they're lining up and sending in their applications by the hundreds and thousands. I mean, that's great for short-term, but long-term, that's no solution.
By the hundreds of thousands to be a census worker,
something like that. Yeah, just a huge backlog of people to get $10 an hour jobs.
Mm. The auto industry was number four on the list, but I'm thinking about the news today that a lot of people at Ford Motor Company are urged to do buyouts here, so that's going to affect another large segment of the auto industry. This was huge news not very long ago. General Motors, Chrysler filing for bankruptcy, the government taking over, becoming auto seller number one, really. That was a story number four. Ford was doing okay then, but they're obviously not doing okay now. This is huge for the American economy as well, this whole story.
It sure is, and that's pretty sobering, isn't it, that Ford, the one of the big three that seemed to be relatively better off, is needing to, again, go back to their workforce and say, we've got to get rid of some of you folks. If that's the best off company, that's pretty sobering. On the other hand, all three of them are still around. Maybe back in the early part of the year, that wouldn't have been a big bet. So I suppose it depends on which way you look at it. They're hanging in there, but not doing great.
How important do you think, David, was the Cash for Clunkers program in stimulating the auto industry this summer?
I think it had a big psychological effect that helped those big three weather the worst psychological period. It got the dealers thinking, hey, people are coming to my store, my showroom, that might not have come otherwise. I've read some of the analyses subsequently that make it seemed pretty clear it wasn't financially as successful as maybe it seemed at the time, and also the gas-saving element was apparently not as useful. Some people were trading in inefficient clunkers and buying SUVs that were barely more efficient. So maybe it wasn't all that it seemed, but I think it was important psychologically. It got people thinking that they could get a new car, that the companies and the dealers were around and busy places rather than desperate, quiet places.
I wonder it wasn't that long ago that SUVs and light trucks made up over half of the American fleet. I wonder what those numbers are now.
Yeah, I think they're way less than they were, but I couldn't give you a new percentage. You're absolutely right. There was the heyday of the SUV. They were more than half the sales. Pretty amazing to think that wasn't very long ago.
Yes.
They've gone way down, but I don't know what the latest percentage is.
Number two on the list was the Obama inauguration last January. It's still, in American history, is such a significant event. He's got a lot of problems, but it was significant.
Yeah, and you, when you mentioned earlier that day seemed long ago, I think you really hit on something because I remember it as such a moving day. I think even a cynical professional journalist, let alone maybe an independent voter, I think a lot of Republicans, a lot of people across the spectrum, I think were moved on that day. And it's striking to think back to that sort of special feeling and how quickly the magic wore off, and people saw this president, whether they like him or don't like him, as someone struggling with the very unromantic day-to-day challenges of governing. It's quite a contrast between the sort of aura, the mystical aura of Inauguration Day, and the real hard work and almost no-win decisions that the president is forced to make.
Why do you think it's been so hard for him? Why do you think his approval ratings a year later are less than 50%, that he's got the progressive wing of the party pretty upset with him? He's got Republicans very upset with him, criticized for different reasons. He's a big government guy, government takeover by the Republicans, and the Democrats are saying the government is not as involved as it should be. I mean, he just can't win.
Yeah, but and I think that it would take a political analyst or somebody writing a book to really thoroughly answer that question. But what leaps to my mind is the easy answer is that a couple of the issues he was inescapably faced with were so tough that you almost had to split the difference, and you almost inevitably were going to antagonize people on the two poles. I'm thinking of Afghanistan. There was no way he was going to please the left and the right. No way. And he didn't. Probably struck a pretty good balance, maybe, but was just going to anger. And then healthcare, maybe the difference with healthcare is I suppose he didn't have to tackle it right away. He could have pushed it back on his time frame, but he had said he was going to start working on that right away. And same thing, there was just no way he was going to please the Liberal poll and the Conservative poll. He certainly hasn't. So I think all of us have seen him wrestle with two extremely tough issues, and there it is. Who's really, really thrilled about either of the choices he's made? The sort of pool that's absolutely excited is probably pretty small.
Right. So do you think next year, I'll make you predict for a moment, we'll be looking at top story of the news year, Republican takeover of the House and Senate?
Yeah, the election will certainly be a big story, and I think the Republicans will make some gains, but will it be such a sweeping comeback by the Republicans that'll be the top story? I'm not sure. It's certainly a great question. If I had to bet money, it'll probably be the economy.
Again, you're right.
You know, in some form or other, that hits everybody in their pocketbook.
It sure does.
Who knows? You know, the election could be pretty dramatic. We'll see.
And yep. Healthcare was number three, and we're still right in the throes of it as we speak.
Yeah, that may dip down a little bit because, as I understand it, the tangible results of any bill that does pass, and I think something will pass, we're all going to be unsure, I think, for many months, if not a couple of years, how it plays out in the real world. But that'll be interesting to track also.
Yeah, it's sort of hard because you feel like you want to know every aspect of the bill, and we don't really have a bill yet, but these are complicated, very, very long bills, and I keep feeling, and there's no way around it, I guess, that we're getting half the story on it,
I mean, I think the critics, if there's something that I think resonates with people trying to follow it from the bill's critics, it's that there are a lot of question marks in this bill, and we don't really know how it will affect a lot of individual Americans and how it will affect the federal budget. And I think that's a fair whatever charge or allegation to make, that we don't really know. Does that mean we shouldn't pass the bill? Maybe we should, but there's definitely a lot of question marks, no question about it.
This hour of the program, we're talking about the top stories of 2009. David Crary is our guest, national reporter for the Associated Press. Since the 1930s, the Associated Press has been putting together this list of the top stories. They ask people who are news editors of papers all over the country to vote, and they had 117 ballots cast for the top 10 stories. Number one, we've already talked about, the economy. Number two, the inauguration of Barack Obama. Number three, health care. And number four, we've talked about too, the audio industry. There are 10 on the list, so we'll talk about some of them, although we won't devote a whole lot of attention to a few of these because a lot was made of them, but maybe too much was made of the stories. What do you think? What were the top stories of this year in your view? And do you imagine, as we've intimated, that the economy will continue to be the top story in 2000? Isn't it hard to believe it's 2010 already? It's getting old. It seems like it was just 2001. Our phone number, join us. We'd love to hear from you and get a great discussion rolling here, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can send an email if you'd like. That is talk@wpr.org. John Treader answering our phones today. Say hi to John. He'll talk to you briefly. We'll get you on the air, and that's that. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Connie Kilmark joins us the second hour of our program this Tuesday, and we'll be looking at getting through the holidays in tough economic times and a number of issues. She's terrific. So she is the founder of the counseling and consulting firm Kilmark and Associates. We go to phone calls now for David, and we start with John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Well, joyeux Noël to you, Kathleen, and your guest.
Thank you. To you, too.
And of course, last week, the forgotten story, it was buried on page 3 of the New York Times business section, was the fact that the UAW was going to have a new president come June, Mr. Robert King, started his career at the UAW in Detroit in the parts department in 1970, And he's an honest-to-God attorney, according to the article. But I say to you that I don't think that the reason that this story was buried on page 3, and, of course, the main story that day was the Bank of America chairman. That got front page treatment. But we are just so, in the labor movement, so forgotten. We have been just so trampled under over actually a 50-year period. I guess a little bit less than that. I marked the date November 22nd, 1963, when President Kennedy was killed, because certainly everything from that date forward has been just an absolute disaster for us in organized labor.
David.
You know, it's, I think John's raising a really good point. There's some incredibly profound social economic trends that happen in our country and obviously in others that you can't really detect in a one-year poll like this. I'd have to look back, but I wonder, for example, if we ever had the civil rights movement as the top story of the year, and we certainly have never even had on our ballot the loss of power by the labor movement in the U.S., and a very, very important phenomenon, very dramatic, and yet because it happens over multiple years, I'm sure it's never been on our ballot. I'm just guessing, but I bet money it's never been. That's tough. He raises a really good point. Maybe we should try to have, stories of the decade or trends of the decade or something
idea.
To get these bigger, longer-term event.
Oh, I like that, David. You should do that.
Yeah, and it probably shouldn't be just the big story, but the big trends.
Yes.
To make clear we're not looking for just a one-day thing.
Thanks, John, for your call.
Thank you, John.
Kathy from Delafield. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. This is just a comment. I've been, reading a lot and listening to the radio a lot, and a comment I have, especially, coming up in what is being said today, too, is people are kind of surprised and disappointed with Barack Obama, and he's not the president that they voted for. And I guess I'm a little bit turned off by that. I feel that they weren't listening to his campaign. They weren't following it, and they weren't listening to his speeches. I think that he's not done anything, in my estimation, that has disappointed me or that I think is out of character than what he stood for during his campaign. For Afghanistan, for instance, you knew that was his number one, foreign objective, that had to be dealt with. So how it was going to be dealt with, you didn't necessarily know, but you knew that he was going to have a strong stance on that. And I think he's really tried to listen to a lot of different voices in coming up with a solution. I think even with healthcare, that was a big strong statement in his campaign, and that he's gone forward with that. And then it's a financial crisis in which he inherited an awful lot of the problems, that he has dealt with that too in character. And so it really troubles me, but it makes me feel that people want 100% guarantees on everything that comes out of government or even what they expect of one another. And that I think that, yes, there needs to be argument, there needs to be discourse, but I think things do need to move forward. And while, for instance, the health bill that's, being discussed, I 100% do not agree with it all. But I also feel there's enough in there that I think is good, it's necessary, and if we do nothing, it's worse, that we need to get something done to move it forward, and that it needs to be revisited and reassessed along the way so it can be made better. But I think there's so diametrically opposed points of view that people are, planting their feet in cement, and they're not going to move on it. And I think a lot of it is self-serving. They like to hear themselves talk and so on. And I'm beginning to feel that that's on both extreme sides, the far right and the far left. And I think Barack Obama is a pragmatist. Everyone knows that. They knew it before he even became president. And I think that's the role he is playing now.
Thank you. Thanks very much for your comments, Kathy. David?
Yeah, that's a pretty articulate analysis. That would make a nice op-ed, almost word for word, what you wrote. I think you hit on a lot of key things. I could go in a lot of directions on that. I think one of the things we're seeing, that you're seeing, Kathy, and we're seeing, is that on the left, Obama supporters may, in their inner conscience, understand that he needs to be pragmatic, that he needs to seek the middle on these tough issues. They may understand that logically, but what they've lost is that enthusiasm, the campaign fervor and the chants and the rallies and stuff, and they're not going to really get that back. And I think that's part of what we're seeing from the liberal side, is a kind of frustration or resignation or even sadness that they all have to grow up, and that this president, as much as they may still like him, it's not going to be the same magic as it was during the campaign. And yeah, I agree with you. That's the way it works in this country, and you can't live in that campaign past. But I think that's part of the frustration from the left. On the other side, I think we're all seeing some people who have even articulated they simply want Obama to fail. That's their goal, not policy X or policy Y, and that's pretty tough too. When the goal of a certain constituency is just to trip this guy up. So you've touched on some really good points, and it's created a kind of fascinating thing now where I think there's still a lot of goodwill toward Obama, but tough psychological situations on the two flanks that he
right.
has to deal with.
Yeah, excellent points from both of you. There is just, David, a lot of power in hope, I think, and those people who were out working for him so tirelessly, and the amount of, which I haven't seen in my lifetime, absolute, utter joy
right.
that
right.
took place at the inauguration, and the sense of history and all of that. It was just,
it was
remarkable.
It was transcendent.
I was
a kid when... little kid when Kennedy was inaugurated, and I imagine there was some of that magic, but certainly since then, I don't think there's been any equivalent to
right.
the Obama fervor.
But I also think that part of the hope was this guy's going to come in and change things in a very significant way for a huge number of people, and so even though hope may die last, the hope has been diminished here that he's going to be able to give us the kind of incredible hope that
right.
we were witnessing on Inauguration Day.
Right, right, exactly. And that's part of, I think, this disillusionment process that's going on. Is it's really not so much what he's done as his enthusiastic supporters realizing it's not going to be the huge, sweeping, wonderful change coming easily and quickly that they might have hoped, perhaps naively, during the campaign.
Right. Elizabeth from Alabama. Hi, Elizabeth.
Well, for sure would, by way of Alabama. Good morning. You mentioned Mr. Querrey. Is that your name, Querrey?
That's right.
That you couldn't really speak to the disparity of an income from the olden days. Well, I can speak to the disparity from the olden days. I was born in 1934 in a small town in Alabama, which was extremely egalitarian. My family were one of the prominent, if you will. It wouldn't have known it at the time, family. Mm-hmm. We were bankers and family owned a lot of other stuff. But nobody cared. And everyone lived relative. It was very egalitarian. I was little neighbors were playing over one day, and I wasn't over 4 years old, and I got out my piggy bank and was showing him my few pennies and a nickel or a dime. My father came in, and I knew he was displeased, but he interrupted the game, put the money away. And after they left, he said, "Those people don't know what a nickel is. Don't ever, ever talk about what you've got in front of somebody who doesn't have a nickel." I didn't have a nickel. But I can't imagine that's happening today.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. I mean, one of the things I cover when I'm not doing the end-of-the-year stories is I write about charities a lot, and it struck me as you were talking, the mixed picture out there. A lot of the very good, hardworking, frontline social service charities are having a tough season, as I'm sure both of you know. Their donations are down, and their demand is up. And yet, even with the donations being down, I keep hearing anecdotal stories of people being very generous at this tough time and heartwarming stories. It doesn't mean that everyone is in that mode, but there still is that kind of generosity and wanting to help out your neighbor, figuratively speaking, even when your own family is struggling. So that's not quite the same as egalitarian, but it's encouraging to me to hear that even in tough times, there still is a well of generosity out there and of caring and wanting to help.
Thank you, Elizabeth, unless you had something else.
No. Well, I would say one more thing.
Sure.
In terms of the generosity, there was a piece on NPR that I have listening to, people complaining because of the spirit in which the gift is given.
Huh.
And I told my I remember telling my granddaughter when she was in high school, she was disparaging of the children who were volunteering at the food food kitchen.
Right.
She said they're only doing it because it'll look good on their resume, you know, on their
right.
From credits to go to
mm-hmm.
college. So I said, do you think that those children are, does it matter? Does it really matter? Do you think the people they're feeding, are they hungry? Yes, they're hungry. Do you think they care why the people are there to feed them? They couldn't care less about anybody's college credentials. They are hungry and they want to be fed, and if your friends can go and do that, it what's in my heart, what's in their heart, really isn't of importance. And I think there's a lot to be said that even if we're given for the wrong reasons, as long as we're given.
You've got a good point, Elizabeth.
Yeah, very good point.
You've got a good point.
All right. I don't know what that's got to do with the most important things of the year. But
it's an important thing of the year.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah,
thank you. Thanks, Elizabeth. I know you have to go. Yeah, I would keep you all over. So let me know when you have to go, David.
I'm fine. Another 5 minutes, whatever works.
Great, yeah. Great. Let's go to Nell from Milwaukee. Hi, Nell.
Hi. I have a couple of things. First, I want to say sometimes these, you know, most important thing of the year is so typically American. We don't seem to have any sense of history or process. And there isn't a darn thing that happened this year that hasn't been many years coming, from, you know, recession or depression or whatever the heck it is, to job loss. That started back with NAFTA, you know, all these things. We have this very short, childlike way of thinking in this country, which I find just absolutely depressing and appalling. And I think it has to do with not having civics and government as part of our education. And history is a joke in education. Then I wanted to also say that the woman who called in talking about how about President Obama and people, you know, and how she is not disappointed in him, made me think of one thing that I think he has done that no other elected official I can think of has ever done, is he absolutely told us when the election's over, it isn't over, and you have to be involved. And he encouraged us to continue with our involvements. And as a result, Organizing for America is very, very much an organization that is growing. And for the first time in my life, I'm involved. I'm actually learning about legislative process for the first time in my life. And we're pulling in more and more people. And we don't all think alike. You know, most of us are Democrats, but we are all over the board. But what we are is absolutely determined to make sure that we stay part of the process and don't give it over to moneyed interests. And so I think if nothing else President Obama has done, he has awakened a lot of us, and we're even pulling in a lot of people who are in poor and desperate situations who have never been part of the process. And so I have to say, that's another wonderful thing about him, and he is a pragmatist, and it's an unfortunate thing, but it is what has to happen for us to be grown-ups in this country and realize that we have to work together and constantly.
David.
Well, that's a great couple of wishes there, aspirations, and let's hope it's not in the easier said than done category. I'm thinking of the civic engagement that you spoke about. That's so important, and I sense that there are people tuning out now, saying, you know, it's not worth being engaged. My campaign work didn't get me the short-term goals I wanted, so I'm not going to get involved in the upcoming election, whatever. I think that's going to happen to an extent. I hope not a lot. I hope people do stay engaged. And, boy, the kind of bridging the political polarization, I think most of us would like to see a lot more civility and a lot more bipartisanship. I find it really depressing to see the extreme polarization now in the Capitol and in D.C. What the solution is to that, though, I don't know. I don't see that going away anytime soon, and that's probably too bad. And then just quickly to touch on your very interesting earlier point about the sort of insularity or provincialism of this top 10 list. It's absolutely true. We found over the years we put various foreign news stories on our ballot as possible things, and they tend not to get many votes, probably for understandable reasons. People are going to vote as big story stuff that's they're familiar with in their own country, but there's some pretty major things that go on overseas that tend not to make these lists, and we notice that, but we don't open this up to journalists around the world. I suppose we could try to do that, but this is a poll for U.S. Journalists, and they tend to vote U.S.-oriented issues.
It's also a good way for us to reflect on the year. I love these polls. I was listening to one of those chat shows last night, and somebody was saying that this particular Congress is the most partisan Congress that he could remember, and maybe the most partisan in U.S. history. Is that the case? It is amazing that you don't get, when you look at health care reform, not one Republican vote. You have a lot of Democrats who aren't happy about it, but you've got all of the Republicans who aren't happy about it. You'd think there would be a couple who would be as unhappy as some progressive Democrats are.
It's startling. I think when they started out, the Democrats were talking, oh, yeah, we can make this a bipartisan bill. We might get one or two votes. And that was their goal. That was the ultimate outside chance. It was to get one or two. They didn't get them. So I find it staggering. And I'm afraid there are other issues, not just the health care, which have come down to that. Some of the votes in the House, where there's many more members and supposedly more diversity of moderates and stuff, it's still extremely polarized. So how you measure it with past eras, I don't know, but it's got to be one of the most polarized climates imaginable.
And that's not likely to change, is it, David?
Well, it's probably going to get worse heading into the next year's elections with all the political sort of ego at stake there. It's hard to see people bridging the gap on any tough issue. It's so probably for the next 11 months, it's not going to get better. Yeah.
Right. We haven't even talked about the other issues. Swine flu. Oh, my gosh. They scared the heck out of us about swine flu. The stories, to watch the way the press dealt with that was so interesting, because there'd be these stories. They were very dramatic stories. We don't know where it's going. And, I'm an anchor, and I got swine flu, and the kids did, and where can you get the shots? And this is going to be a horrible pandemic, and a quarter of the people in the world are going to die. And I know they didn't know where to go with the story, but it was a significant story, but they scared the heck out of us.
Yeah, we noticed that syndrome when a big hurricane is coming way out days away in in the Caribbean, and the news media now just builds it up as though this hurricane is going to be the cataclysm of all time, and with Katrina, it turned out to be, although we all know that was not really the hurricane, but the levee system. In any case, the swine flu kind of reminded me of that, because I think the news media feels it's better to err on the side of over frightening people than the other way, and to underestimate stuff. And that leads to some interesting decisions in terms of reporting. Swine flu was big. If you look at the death toll that the CDC just reported the other day, I mean, I think they said 10,000 Americans had died.
That's a lot.
Swine
yes.
flu. So that's not inconsequential, but was it a life-changing, earth-shattering pandemic? No, it wasn't. So it's tough to get the right balance on these things.
Right. Afghanistan is number 6 on your list, and who knows where that story is going to go?
Yeah, and that is what I was touching on before. That was, in effect, the only foreign story on our list, and of course it's only partly a foreign story because it involves our troops and our national security, et cetera, et cetera. So it has a huge U.S. angle, and where's that going to go? Lord knows. I mean, it's so many things contributing to a mess there. Afghani politics is a mess. The warlords out there, the Taliban that seems to be amazingly resilient as an enemy. They're hard to put away. So, yeah, that's a story that will probably still be there next year and maybe the year after.
Yes, I'm sure. Michael Jackson dies, number 7. This is a story that was nonstop cable news for days.
Yeah, and this was one going back to the alternate public poll that we started for the first time this year. This was one of the few notable differences, as Jackson's death was number 3 on the public poll. And my guess is that there might be more, a younger demographic that participate in that, or maybe just people who are more into pop culture. So his death was 3 on the Facebook poll that we did, and was number 7 in the news editors and news directors poll. But it was a huge story, and that one actually was amazing to me, and what a global story it was. It was easy for me to forget that his legions of fans are everywhere.
Yes, I'm with you on that. I was amazed, too, the gatherings all over the world.
Right.
The Fort Hood Rampage is number 8. What a horrendous story that was this year.
Yeah, that was one of the few that was really just a story of relatively short duration. Obviously, there are investigations still going on, and the story is not, quote-unquote, over. But it was one of the few that basically happened on one day, one incident that was so riveting and dismaying to people that it stuck in their minds, and they put it on this list. Most of the others are kind of longer, more complex trend stories. This was one incident that was just shocking to people.
Mm-hmm. Edward Kennedy dying.
Yeah, it's not often that deaths make these lists. It needs to be a larger-than-life person. I think Michael Jackson and Teddy Kennedy both fit that bill. They weren't just famous people. They were icons that really had been part of people's lives and memories for decades. And so their loss was felt across generations in a very deep way.
Yes, and finally, how about that Chesley Sullenberger? That was such an inspirational, wonderful story.
Yeah, and that made both lists. You know, what does it mean in the long term in terms of our economy, our national security, our politics? I suppose you could say, you know, it doesn't really mean a lot. It was such a wonderful story.
It was
just a plain old good news story on the list. That probably doesn't happen very often either. And there was nothing about that story except almost childlike wonder and pleasure at how it worked out.
Yes, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, David, you've been a real treat. Please join us again. We'd love to have you on the
All right. Well, we'll make a date for next year.
Great.
Maybe,
before the end happens. Of the year. Okay. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Yeah,
all the best
you.
To you.
Yes, to you as well. Happy holiday season and great stories for 2010. David is on deadline, so he couldn't stay with us for a full hour, but gave us most of the hour. National reporter for the Associated Press, David Crary. And we're talking about the Associated Press. I follow these every year. I have for years now. Their top 10 stories, according to those who voted, news editors from around the country, 117 ballots cast for the top 10 stories. In case you've missed, because we're going to ask you your top 3 or so, if you want to disagree with the list or say, I agree, those are the top 10 stories, or add something to the list, you've got about 5 minutes to do that. I thought we could do that for the end of the show. The economy, Obama inauguration, healthcare, auto industry, swine flu, Afghanistan, Michael Jackson dies, Fort Hood rampage, Edward Kennedy dies, and Miracle on the Hudson. Those, according to the Associated Press's poll, are the top 10 stories. What do you think? Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can send an email as well. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're spending the last few minutes polling you about your thoughts concerning the top 10 news stories of 2009. We have some lines open. Join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we'd like very much to hear from you. Would you agree with what we've already Sid was on the list is in terms of Associated Press's top stories. I want to tell you a couple of things. One is Connie Kilmark will be joining us the second hour of our program today. Connie will talk about getting through the holidays, these very tough economic times. We'll talk about unemployment. We'll talk about the traditions that we carry on in our family, even though, and how you change some of those traditions. If finances are hard for you this year and you grew up when gifts were plentiful and people had more money, how do you make that kind of tradition? How do you give meaningfully the ins and outs of what families do? All of that we'll be talking about with Connie, who is the founder of the counseling and consulting firm Kilmark & Associates and has joined all of us here who do all the shows on Wisconsin Public Radio pretty frequently. All right, call me. Where the heck are you? I can't believe you didn't call. It's only a few minutes. You only get to vote for a few minutes. 800-486-8655. Maybe we should narrow it the top news story for you from 2009. How's that? You can answer that one. Let's go to Tim from Milwaukee. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Hi.
I have what I think should be a top story, but it's, I don't think it's going to make any lists. But I believe it's the cause of many of our problems in the economy, healthcare, on and on, and our inability to deal with these problems, and that is the influence of money
right.
in our government.
Mm-hmm.
Our government no longer represents the majority of the people, and a lot of these domestic issues you've been talking about, I believe, stem from that. And until we Americans start thinking about that and changing that, we're going to have problems.
And for how many years have we talked about this issue? Years and years and years.
And it's to the point now where it's just silly.
And do you think that it had a big influence on the health care bill that we're going to get?
Yes, I do. When you have the industry basically writing legislation. We have some representatives trying to do the job of the people, but it's an uphill battle. They can't win anymore.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, thanks very much. All right, Tim has added a whole new thing. Money in politics is the number one issue as it played out in healthcare reform, and it plays out in many things. Well, what about the issue? I can't tell you how many shows we've done on campaign finance reform over the years, but doesn't happen. Much of it doesn't happen in a huge, significant way. We're filling out the hour talking about your top story of 2009. Just a reminder as we're getting the calls in that we do have a list. We will shortly. A link of book suggestions from our show yesterday on books, which was so much fun. Had a great time doing that. And if you go to our Facebook page, that was my discovery in 2009, Facebook. I love Facebook now. We're on the Kathleen Dunn Show, and there will be a link. Rhonda's putting it up there today, so there will be a link to some of the many books that we talked about yesterday. We were just rolling. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we go to Viola from Green Bay. Hi, Viola.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say I was born in 1930. I'm 79 years old, and I lived through the Depression. And I think when time goes by, Obama is going to be another Franklin D. We need him. We need his ideas, and I think that was the most important thing of this year. So I just wanted to congratulate him on what he's trying to do.
So you think he's been criticized a bit too much, Viola, the past few months?
Excuse me?
Do you think he's been receiving too much criticism?
I think so. I think so. I think he needs credit. I just think he's a man of the time and someone that really cares about the United States and what's happening.
Mm-hmm. 1930, you're going to have a big birthday next year.
I'll see.
I hope you have a nice party.
Oh, thank you.
Okay,
I had a big one at my 75th.
Did you? Okay. Hey, just keep rolling, huh?
Yeah.
That's good.
The name of my book is Woodside Stories. It's on the web.
Uh-huh.
www.woodsidestories. And it is about how we coped with the Depression, how we got by, and then also on the days of the World War II. And
okay.
So this program is really good.
Thanks, Viola. Thanks very much for your call. Bud from Waukesha. Hi, Bud.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Real quick, the story I think we're going to be hearing more about, needing to think more about, the family and the C Street phenomenon in government. Folks who assume that by virtue of their having temporary political power, they have been designated the select by what they consider to be the almighty. And ordinary rules of what we would traditionally call Christian behavior simply don't matter to them. They're more important than any rules about, say, adultery. Witness the governor of South Carolina. And their important function is to stay in power, increase their power, go abroad, spread their ideology, and tell, for instance, nations in Africa that they should be executing gay people.
Did you read that book? It's just an incredible read, isn't it?
It's shattering. I mean, it's not an easy read.
No, it's not.
But it kind of goes to a large story of who are we? Mm-hmm. Where are there people growing up in this country who know better than what the rest of us just assume is basic morality?
Yeah, thanks, Bud. We're out of time. We did an interview last week with the author. It was very good. In case you missed it, you can go to our archives. Thanks, Bud. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. To Rhonda Fanning, thanks for producing the program. John Treader, on-air production. We have another hour. We'll be with you following the news on the Ideas Network.